Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling into Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of this conference, you will be transferred back into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions on today's seminar. A handout for today is available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, click on the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center, and then click on the link that says Eating Disorder Education and Resources, and finally click the link that says Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen, by today's date, you'll find today's handout. Once again, visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center, then click where it says Eating Disorder Education and Resources, and finally click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen next to today's date, you will find today's handout. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Michael Barrett. Dr. Barrett is a licensed psychologist and is the CEO, Executive Director, and Co-Founder of the Center for Change. Today, he will be sharing information on how family and friends can best help a loved one who is suffering from an eating disorder. Welcome, Dr. Barrett.
Thank you. And I want to welcome everybody on this call. I'm really honored to have this chance to speak with you all. And I'm grateful to Kate and for Cigna for giving me this opportunity. I ask you all, if you don't like what I say, please don't hold Cigna responsible. I'm responsible for all the things that I say. I've been working with eating disorder clients for 28 years, and I'm going to share a little bit of that experience through my ideas today for each one of you. And I want to welcome everybody. This workshop's kind of designed for people who are helping loved ones with eating disorders, but it's also very practical, I think, for those who are suffering with eating disorders. So I welcome all of you who are here. I'm also going to be talking in generality, so obviously, specifically with your loved one, you might have to tweak the things that I say and take things with a grain of salt as it applies to your own loved one. I start with a quote by one of my favorite philosophers, Eric Hoffer, who once said, "In times of change, true learners inherit the earth, while the learned become beautifully equipped to deal with a world that no longer exists." And I say that with humility, understanding that none of us know as much as we wish we knew about eating disorders. But hopefully today we can all be learners, be humble, have an open heart, and see what we can get out of this workshop. So I'm excited to visit with you today. I have a handout of my slideshow. I don't have numbers on the slides, but if you'll kind of stick with me, I'll try to guide you and show you guys where I'm at in the PowerPoint that you're looking at. Four things that we're going to cover today. I'm on slide number three, is key truths about eating disorders. We're going to talk about why some people have eating disorders, what the eating disorder client is going through, what's it like for them, and then what families and loved ones can do. And hopefully there will be enough time to really talk about some things we can do. So we should be on the slide, key truths about eating disorders. At the top, I already talked a little bit about being a learner. I want to talk a little bit about what eating disorders are not. And eating disorders are not cheap attempts at attention. They're not about vanity. They're not a diet gone crazy or awry. They're not a willful or chosen illness. And for most people, it's definitely not a lifelong illness. And So I just want to remind us all, people with eating disorders don't choose their illness. They may choose eating disorder behaviors, but they don't choose this illness. It is a mental illness, and the beautiful thing is that I believe, and most of my colleagues who have been doing this for a long time, that people can choose to recover from it. That if they stick in treatment and don't give up, that the vast majority will actually recover fully from their eating disorder. On that same slide, what eating disorders are? Eating disorders are a silent thief. They steal people's lives. They steal the quality of life. They are a fallacy of friendship. What I mean is many with eating disorders consider this illness to become their friend. They depend on it. They feel close to it. And it's important to know that it's not the friend. It actually can kill you. And good friends don't kill you. It's a serious mental illness. It's just as much a mental illness as psychosis, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or anything else. It's the most deadly mental illness, anorexia is, and these illnesses of eating disorders do cause biochemical and hormonal and neurotransmitter imbalances in the brain, and the perceptual distortions and body dysmorphia that can come with those with the illness can achieve psychotic proportions. And so this eating disorder becomes a full-blown mental illness. Like I said, the beauty of it is that people can attain a full recovery from this illness. And so I give a hopeful message today that it's not only possible, but it's probable that those that you love with these illnesses will get well. The key is to get in treatment and stay in treatment and stick with it until you get on the other side. Last of all, what eating disorders are. I've never met an eating disorder client, and I've had many, many of them who didn't have a little bit of this mentality on the inside, which was something like this. I don't think I'm going to be able to have the good things in life, long-term loving relationships or self-respect or comfort inside of my own body. But because I have so many deficits, I'm never going to have those other good things that people have, but at least I have this. And what, if you could see my hand, it's kind of like a closed hand. At least I have this in my hand. I have this illness, and it helps me. And the eating disorder often becomes, to clients who are so suffering, the consolation prize, which clients begin to settle for because they don't feel like they can have the real things. And thus, part of treatment is getting people to dream again about their passion, the purpose of their lives, their dreams, and to begin to go for what they really want instead of settle for this illness that they feel that they're going to be stuck with. I'm still on that third plate, the third slide. Most often there's co-occurring illness. We usually don't see eating disorders alone. There's most often other mental illnesses attached, especially when people need care in a 24-hour setting. There's often four or five DSM diagnoses as well. Major depression in 60 to 70% of people with eating disorders, anxiety disorders in 40% of folks suffering with eating disorders. There's oftentimes cross-addiction, cutting or self-mutilation, drug or alcohol addiction, stealing, and many other cross addictions. The eating disorders often usually don't come in a single package, which makes them also complicated to treat. We need a new model of self-worth for our clients with eating disorders, and we must help our clients defy the eating disorder model of self-worth, which is the Western culture model for self-worth times about 1,000, and that is, I will know if I'm worth something based on, number one, my appearance, number two, achievement, and number three, approval. And if that's a model of self-worth, that is a setup for failure, because Our appearance can change. We don't get to micromanage and manipulate our appearance. We have genetic factors, and approval is a nice thing, but it doesn't last very long. And so we have to find another way of knowing that we're all right. And I invite my clients to look at internal things such as the intent of the heart, effort, hard work, principles by which people live, and other internal things rather than just looking at externals for a model of self-worth. Let's move on to the next slide. At the top it says, why do some people have eating disorders? Well, it is very complicated. We don't know exactly why people have eating disorders, but what we do know in latest research is risk factors. What are the biggest factors that create risk for someone developing an eating disorder? And they are these. Number one, a family history for eating disorders. And that can be a family history for somebody with eating disorders where the client or the patient may or may not know that that person has an eating disorder. Number two is family history for depressive or anxiety disorders. This may be a risk factor because people with eating disorders may tend to use that illness as a way to self-medicate depression or anxiety disorders. Number three, a family history for drug or alcohol abuse. I don't know why this is a risk factor, but it may be a family context within a family where drugs or alcohols or other substances are used to deal with life struggles and difficulties. And we can say that definitely with eating disorders, either avoiding food or going to food does become a way for those suffering to deal with life difficulties. The next risk factor is high BMI, which is body mass index. In those early physical or sexual developmental years, and for whatever reason, someone who's bigger than other people is at a higher risk for developing an eating disorder, whether it's height or fat content or bone size and frame. If they're bigger, there's a little higher risk. The next risk factor is early onset of menses or menarche. The earlier a person has their first period, the higher risk for an eating disorder. That may be based on the idea that someone with those changes going on in a developing body at age 10, 11, 12, 13, it may be more difficult for someone who's 10 or 11 to deal with all those changes than somebody who's 12 or 13. And our young girls, unfortunately, our bodies are changing, and one thing they are thinking and feeling often is, I don't know what's happening to my body, but whatever's happening doesn't feel like it's going to be acceptable in our fashion-driven society out there. The next one is personality temperament. Now, this isn't personality disorder or personality type, but temperament, and there's three which have been linked to risk for development of an eating disorder. Number one, impulsivity. Obviously, if someone has a kind of an impulsive tendency, they're at higher risk for binge eating disorder or bulimia. And the other two, perfectionism and ruminative worrying, and these apply equally to all eating disorders. People tend to feel that they have to be perfect to make up for their deficits. Sometimes they feel like they have to be perfect in everything. Sometimes they feel like they have to be perfect in something to make up for their own self-perceived deficits that are often not real. But that perfectionism can really play a role in the development of an eating disorder. Ruminative worrying also is this worrying that about family members where people feel out of control. They can't control the happiness of their family. They feel that they have to fix it, make people better or happy, and they can't. And sometimes this is a seedbed for early feelings of inadequacy and powerlessness, which can feed into the development of an eating disorder. Other risk factors that aren't quite as strong but present are these four. History of repetitive, excessive, and extreme dieting, and the more excessive or extreme and repetitive, the higher risk for development of an eating disorder. The next is exposure to fashion industry, media, the thin ideal. Some people brush against it, as all of us do in our culture, which we're a part of. Some people tend to live in those things and have a regular diet of comparing themselves to the external world to know if they're all right. Next, activities which have pressure for specific body size. Now, this can be diving, swimming, long-distance running, dancing, gymnastics, some of these things where there's pressure to be a specific body size in the aid of performance. Sometimes they can put pressure on, even though that doesn't mean people should not do those things. Some people, I think, were made to do some of those things, and that's their passion. But we just have to be aware. We have to be cautious and keep our eye on things. Last of all, on that last bullet point on this slide, it says certain combination for some becomes, quote, the perfect storm for an eating disorder. In the movie Perfect Storm, I believe that it was barometric pressure and weather and wind and moisture and all of those things combined with the perfect storm, which was unprecedented and created loss of life on a boat out in the Bering Sea, I think it was. And sometimes for eating disorders, these combinations can become, quote, a perfect storm for those who end up developing an eating disorder. On the other hand, sometimes people have many of those risk factors and don't have an eating disorder, and some of them have very few and have an eating disorder, and so it all depends on so many things. It's complicated, and I hope someday we understand it better, but at least we know what some of those main risk factors are. The next slide is, what is the eating disorder client experiencing? What are they going through, and what is their life like? First bullet point is poor self-esteem. I've never met anybody with an eating disorder that wasn't suffering with self-esteem. It's something that we can all work and help those suffering with. Number two, loss of sense of spiritual worth and identity. Just a disconnection from their own personal sense of spiritual worth. Who am I? What am I good at? What's my value? And in this illness, people become more connected to it and less connected to their higher power, to themselves, and to those around them who love them. It's part of the way the illness develops. It's a progression. People begin sometimes the external steps in eating disorders with attempts at self-improvement. I want to look better. I want to lose a couple pounds. Whatever that is, eventually it can turn into a coping style, then into a full-blown addiction, and eventually in the development of this illness, it becomes an identity, and people with eating disorders can eventually believe that the illness is really who they are, not just an illness that they have. I've talked about the biochemical imbalances, all of these things as part of what the client is going through. The person often becomes externalized and performance-driven while feeling no matter what they do, it's never good enough for them to make a difference in their self-esteem. And I've already talked a little bit about the self-defeating model of self-esteem and the need to get another one. The next slide, what is the eating disorder client experiencing continued? The internal dialogue, which is self-degrading and relentless, and I put, it's hell, it's difficult. There's a lot of negative talk and thoughts going on inside of the mind. There's a disconnection from the heart, and that is the deeper impressions that a person may have of what they need to do to take good care of themselves. They believe there are the exceptions to the good things in life, that others can have them, but they will not or cannot or don't deserve it. I've talked already about the settling for the consolation prize. And some people with eating disorders come from homes and upbringing where they haven't had a lot of love. Most of the clients I've seen came from good families where they had much love and good, they were loved well. And if love was all that was necessary, they'd already be better. But what our clients often have as common is a difficult time letting that love in to their lives. So with that, we're going to head into a few slides here. There's quite a few. Hopefully I won't lose you. But what families and friends can do to help is the beginning of the next few slides that I'm on. I may skip a few bullet points and move on, but I'll try to keep you with me as I go. First of all, we can't single-handedly fix or cure or save someone from an eating disorder, but we can do our part. And we need to realize this, otherwise we're going to feel very guilty and very helpless about not being able to save them or fix them. We must create a support system for us and take good care of us and keep our lives going, even though those with eating disorders may be having a hard time just staying alive. Having a team is important in eating disorder treatment where it's possible and where there are providers in your area, a medical doctor, a therapist, master's or PhD level is great, and a dietitian who specializes in eating disorders makes a great team. And that's a recommendation if it's possible. We need to learn everything we can about eating disorders. I suggest a couple of simple books, a couple of good writers. One good writer is Carolyn Costin, C-O-S-T-I-N, who's got some nice books out. Margot Maine, M-A-M-A-I-N-E, has some great books. Another one is Jenny Schaefer, S-C-H-A-E-F-E-R, has some great books out that are easy to read and give a lot of information that we can learn about eating disorders. At the bottom of this slide, it says support consistent and appropriate nourishment or feeding of the brain. This is so critical. You know, no matter what else we're doing to help, we need to try to do everything we can to make sure our loved ones are getting proper nourishment and regular nourishment. And this doesn't just apply to people who are severely underweight. It also may apply to people who are at normal weight or overweight, who also are chaotic in their eating style. And those folks can also have malnourishment. And whatever we do goes much better if people are nourished. The next slide, at the top it says provide structure with food as needed. How much structure depends on the age of the person suffering. It depends on the ability of family to provide that, how well mom and dad are getting together or getting along and have similar ideas about the food. But structure is important. Even if it's just, say, let's sit down together as a family three times a day and be together and give opportunity to eat, even that can be helpful. We can create structures for talking and connecting, and activities are so important. Much research says that even just sitting down once a day at a meal as a family is protection against drug and alcohol abuse, gang-related behavior, and other ills of our society. It's important to take time to connect and talk and to just be together. The next bullet point says structure is anything that makes it more difficult to engage in eating disorder behavior or easier not to. We provide structures and treatment, whether it's outpatient or inpatient, and in addition to love and concern and compassion, that's mainly what treatment is about, is to create structure. And structures can be anything. It could be for a family member to check in before somebody goes to bed and say, how was your day and how did you do today? It could be a family member waiting for a half hour after meal before they use the bathroom. All these little structures make it a little easier to not engage in the behavior. The next bullet point is use your power and leverage to help those suffering with eating disorders to keep their life kind of simple, especially while they're in it. A lot of our clients are overachievers and perfectionistic, and they think they can do more than they can do when they're right in the throes of an eating disorder. They often have a hard time saying, I'm having a hard time, I'm overwhelmed, I need help. And so we can simplify their lives a little bit as we can rather than embracing or enabling them in overbooking and overdoing their lives. And that's one thing that we can maybe have an influence on with our loved ones. The next one, quit blaming yourself for the eating disorder. It's not your fault. You didn't create it. You couldn't create it. It's way too complicated. And at the bottom there, the last one on this page, or this plate, it says, take ownership for your own weaknesses and struggles as an example. This is important, not that we take responsibility for the eating disorder because we didn't create it, but we can take responsibility for our own difficulties and weaknesses and model that for our family members to be able to say, I'm not perfect, I have my own struggle and problems, but this is what I'm doing to work on them. And that's a good example, I think, for our loved ones with eating disorders. The next page, what families and friends can do to help. At the top it says, look at intergenerational patterns which impact family members in negative or positive ways. And underneath it says family rules about food. We can look at how our attitudes about food and body in our families and maybe make a few adjustments. Some simple things might be helpful, like have less fashion magazines in the home. It could be because they don't help. In fact, they can lead to increased depression and poor body image the more time we spend in those magazines. We can talk about dieting less and make that less of a big theme in our families. We can help our loved ones avoid avoidance. A lot of times the illness becomes kind of an illness of avoidance. It's where they go when our clients are often afraid to face some of the difficult things in life. We can help them have the courage and know what step that they can take to take a step into life and away from the illness. We can help them define our role in their recovery. That's one thing we should be asking them is, what do you want me to do? What is my role? What can I do? We can also ask, what helps? What doesn't help? What can I say? When I say this, does it help or does it not help? And then we can diligently follow through with the role they give us, even when they don't want us to, in those moments where they want to do their eating disorder. The next slide at the top, it says, ask them of your role in accountability. It doesn't have to be family members that hold people with eating disorders accountable, but folks with eating disorders need to be accountable to someone. A family member, a doctor, a therapist, a dietitian, someone where they're telling the truth about how they're doing internally, externally, in eating disorder behaviors, in their honesty or their dishonesty, and in how they're feeling about themselves, their thoughts and feelings on the inside. That's absolutely critical that they're accountable to someone. And as a family member, we may or may not be the right person for that, but we need to make sure that they're being accountable to someone. We can let them know of our expectation of complete honesty. They need to be honest. Honesty is imperative for recovery, to learn how to become more honest about how they're really doing it. And we believe in perfectionism, in self-correction rather than perfectionism. None of us are going to be absolutely perfect in honesty, but we can self-correct. If we find ourselves less than honest, we can fix that immediately. We can make a phone call or send a text or clear that up in our next session or visit if we're a client. And those who work hard on self-correction to stay honest do well in recovery. Next one is to become and stay engaged in their life. Again, it's our job to make it difficult for them to push us away and to not let them push us away. In their moments of overwhelmness or feeling of unworthiness or anger and frustration, they may want to push us away, but stay engaged. We won't have the magic words. We won't always know what to say, but we can always at least be there and to be close. Last one on this plate is to have a voice. Speak with respect, but quit walking on eggshells. That's not necessary. tell the truth about how you feel and what you think and what you noticed. Leave diagnoses out of it. Leave judgment out of it. Don't make assumptions, but just tell people what you've noticed and how you feel and what you're worried about. And don't be afraid to get involved. As a father, I can tell all of you personally, I have a lot more regrets in my life raising my children in those things that I didn't do or didn't say than I do in those things I did do or did say. Sometimes our fear gets in the way and we just back up, especially often true of fathers with young women suffering with eating disorders, but it can be true of all of us. On the next slide, at the top it says, love them unconditionally. Express that love often and fully and face-to-face and in writing. There's a great book coming out soon about, it says The Diaries of Ashley. It's by a father who had a daughter with an eating disorder. His name is Dan Blackwell. And watch out for that book. It's going to be a great one. So don't be afraid to express your love for them, that you care about them, and do it more fully than you usually do, face-to-face or in writing. That's important. The next bullet point there says, hold up the mirror of their goodness, spirituality, their strength, their progress, and their success for them to see, because they'll have a hard time seeing it. So tell them. Also express your belief in them, no matter how hopeless you feel in any moment when things are tough. Let them know that they can do this, that you know they can recover, that you believe that they will, and that you believe in their strength and ability to transcend this illness eventually, step by step. These next two are very important. Create opportunities where you spend time with your loved ones suffering with an eating disorder where you never talk about the eating disorder. You talk about everything else, about them, their life, whatever else is there. And then obviously it'll be important to have times where you can talk about the eating disorder. And then when you're done, talk about it as thoroughly as you can to put it on the shelf and go to other places in your relationship. This next one's important. Disconnect love from achievement. Teach and support a new model of self-worth that includes intention and effort and courage and character and passion and purpose, and not only who they are, but who they might become because of their capacity. So a lot of times as parents, I've done this plenty where I've really reinforced my children and expressed my admiration when they accomplish something fantastic, which a lot of times our children do. But we need to express our love and admiration from them that's not connected to achievement, but more connected to them just being and living and breathing and the kind of person they are, either with or without achievements. The next slide, creating structures and taking opportunities for deepening connections. One of the impacts of an eating disorder illness is to decrease the connectedness between one's self and a person with an illness and themselves, with others who love them, with a higher power, if they believe in a higher power. And deepening those relationships is important. It may be pondering and meditating. It may be yoga. It may be prayer. It may be reaching out to friends, asking for help when they need it, and maybe expressing love at a deeper level. Sometimes in groups in our program, we'll do things like daddy-daughter dances and have the fathers and daughters whisper and talk to each other in the ear and say things they've wanted to say but they've been uncomfortable or scared to say while they're dancing. Sometimes we can create opportunities in families, such as having a gratitude meeting where people get to express out loud feelings of gratitude. Sometimes it takes a little effort to create structures in our families to have deeper connections and to discuss deeper things, but we can definitely do that. Let's see, the next bullet point is help them verbalize their own positive thoughts about what they've done. Research in self-esteem has shown that when we tell people how great they are, a lot of times it bounces off. If we can ask people how they feel about what they did or who they are and they say it, if they say it, it'll go in and then we can validate those feelings. So a lot of times we can learn to ask questions like, how do you feel about what you've done? How do you feel about the accomplishments that you've made? How do you feel about your effort, even though you didn't achieve things the way you really wanted to? And then we can add to those questions after they've validated themselves. Winding down here, be the kind of example you want for them. You know, we're always trying to find magic words that'll help or create a transcendent moment with someone that we love or make a difference in their life, and sometimes that does happen. More often, it's our quiet example that teaches them the most. It's the most powerful intervention there is us being the best that we can be and providing that example for them. We can help our loved ones have feelings without judgment. Sometimes our loved ones are overwhelmed by their emotion. They're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings they have without managing those with eating disorders or other unhealthy ways to manage emotion. And one of the reasons why people have a hard time feeling overwhelmed by emotion is because they judge themselves for it intensely. So, for example, if someone with an eating disorder is angry at a parent, they will often punish themselves for being angry because they feel ungrateful. If they feel angry towards a loving parent, even though it's normal to be angry sometimes at people that we love when we feel hurt. And so we need to teach them to have feelings without self-judgment. Our eating disorder clients, most often, when they feel weak or inadequate, they judge themselves tremendously for not being, quote, strong enough or big enough or strong enough to handle life without help. We need to help them with that. And last of all, I think we need to help them listen to the heart. And it's just my belief that we have emotion and we have thoughts that inform us and help us. And these are important. It's part of what we deal with in therapy all the time. But I suggest that there's also what I would call the heart, and there, which is in there resides our deeper thoughts and feelings, and it's connected to the purpose of our lives and our dreams and our passions and our values and who we are. So we need to teach our clients again to, just as we need to teach them again to listen to their hunger, fullness, and satiety inside of their bodies when it comes to food and re-nourishing their bodies, we also need to help them listen to their hearts and listen to who they really are again. Oftentimes, those with eating disorders feel they can't trust themselves, they can't trust their heart, their impressions, their feelings, and they avoid doing that because they think that's where they've gone wrong. And it's my belief what we really need to do is teach them they can trust the heart. They need to listen to that and to not listen to and obey the eating disorder and those thoughts and feelings that come from this illness in the mind. So with that, I guess I'll leave this, the final idea that it does take a village to raise a child. It takes more than a good family. I can say that I have a large family with many children. One of my daughters suffered with an eating disorder, and I know what it's like to feel guilty and incompetent, and not only as a father but also as a professional. After treating a couple of thousand patients, I couldn't even make sure that my own daughter did not have an eating disorder. But nonetheless, I could do my small role, and I'm happy to say because of my daughter's hard work and good help from many, she's been out of her eating disorder for 5 years and would describe herself now moving from in recovery to fully recovered from her eating disorder. So my biggest message to you all is there is hope, and there's high hope and reasons to believe that if we keep working, if they keep working, then good things will happen. And this illness can be something that they've learned from, something they can take from into their life for good, but something that won't plague them the rest of their life. And with that, I guess I'll end my presentation.
And to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. After I finish reading the entire question and all possible answers, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Question 1. This session provided me with a better understanding of what a person with an eating disorder is experiencing. 1. Strongly agree. 2. Agree. 3. Disagree. 4. Strongly disagree. Question 2. This session educated me on what I can do to help a family member or a friend with an eating disorder. 1. Strongly agree. 2. Agree. 3. Disagree. 4. Strongly disagree. Question 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. 1. Strongly agree. 2. Agree. 3. Disagree. 4. Strongly disagree. Question 4. I would recommend this program to others. 1 if you agree, or 2 if you do not agree. Question 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. 1. I am an individual with an eating disorder. 2. I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. 3. I am a health professional. Or 4. Other. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please be aware that a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. At that point, please state your name before posing your question. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press star 1 to be placed in the queue. We will take our first question.
Hi, this is Marianne. I would like to know who you have in Houston, Texas that you recommend for eating disorders.
Send me an email and I'll send it to you.
What's your email?
It's Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L,
mm-hmm.
dot Barrett, B-E-R-R-E-T-T.
Mm-hmm.
At uhsinc.com.
uhsinc.com.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And once again, please press star 1 to ask your question. And with no further questions in the phone queue, I'd like to turn it back to today's speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Just want to thank you all for taking the time to be all of us together today, and I hope you at least got a little something out of it, and I guess keep your head up and keep going. That's what I hope for each one of you. And that's it.
Right, and I want to say thank you so much to Dr. Barrett for providing us with such wonderful insights today. And if anyone on the call today has any specific questions about any of the treatment options discussed, please contact Cigna's Eating Disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Also, please mark your calendars for our next Eating Disorder Awareness Seminar next month. It'll be on Tuesday, September 25th at 1 p.m. Eastern. That's noon Central and 10 Pacific. Thanks so much, everyone.
This does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.